Huggins had a lot of good ideas that fall when he first had his paper route. But somehow his ideas had a way of not turning out as he had planned. Something always went wrong. There was, for example, that Saturday afternoon in October when Henry found himself with nothing to do until it was time to start delivering journals.
You've just heard the opening lines to Beverly Cleary's Henry and the Clubhouse. I'm John McCoy.
I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And this is Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. As I was reading this through, it occurred to me that I got a lot of ideas about what childhood was supposed to be from Henry Huggins.
Yeah.
You know, I went out and I had a paper route. And in part because I had read Henry Huggins and I thought, oh, that sounds like something kids do. I better get a paper route. And similarly, this is a book about making a clubhouse.
Yeah.
And I thought, hey, I got to make a clubhouse. And I desperately wanted to make a clubhouse. Now, I never got to because my parents didn't want some lousy, you know, stapled together pieces of thrown off plywood in their backyard. But this really, this stuck in my head as like the quintessential idea of what life was supposed to be like if you're a boy in an American suburb.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the point of it.
Did you have a clubhouse when you were a kid?
We had, well, we didn't have like, hey, gang, let's get together and throw together some wood and make a clubhouse. Like my dad built us like a clubhouse in the backyard. We called it the tree house, but it wasn't actually in a tree. But it was elevated, so you had to climb a little ladder to get up to it. And it had a little platform. A little, like, it didn't have a door or anything, but it was covered. And it was just like a little, basically it was like a large box with a doorway, I think a window, and a platform.
Right.
And he built that when we were really little, and I don't even know when it got torn down, but it was in our backyard for a little. I don't even think there's any pictures of it, but that was our clubhouse. Yeah, I know. Lost to the ages, lost to memory.
You know, I worry as we talk about this, like, that we are going to turn into two old fogies on the internet complaining about how kids today don't get out and play in the yard or something.
No, that's. I think it's fine. I was never a kid who liked playing out in the yard, so I only did it because I thought that's what kids were supposed to do. My parents made me go outside, so I think it's a perfectly valid thing to talk about. No, I think that that Henry in the Clubhouse, I think it serves as a fine. It's not the most satisfying. Well, no, I think that's actually. I think in my note taking, I realized that it actually was a more satisfying closing of the Henry series than I initially thought. Considering that he continues on as a character for a while.
Yeah, it encapsulates a lot of what we've seen Henry moving towards. It's got, it actually has a plot.
Yes.
And it has a plot where events early in the book actually affect things that happen later in the book.
Yes.
And it continues to build this world of Clickitat Street. We have returning characters. We have, I think, a deeper look into the mind of Ramona than we get in any of the books so far.
And
it's quite telling that after this, she drops Henry and moves on to Ramona. On the other hand, reading it through this time, I felt like Henry was kind of a blank slate to me. You know, his motivations here were not so, you know how every Henry Huggins story begins with Henry saying, I sure wish something would happen today.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, I felt, I sure wish Henry would care about what he's doing.
I sure wish Henry would stop depending on other people to motivate his life. Tell him what to do. But no, I feel like there was a very conscious choice on her part to kind of close out Henry's character arc. By having, I don't know, like, it seems like the motivations in this book, even though it kind of has a similar thread to, you know, him wanting to get a bike, then him wanting to, you know, go on a fishing trip with his dad, him wanting to get a paper out. But this one's a lot more of an internal mission, which is he wants to prove he's responsible. Like, he wants to become responsible. He wants to be the kind of boy who can take care of a paper route and have a clubhouse and take care of his own problems. And I think that I think that she succeeds in doing that. I think she succeeds in like saying like, and he reached another point in his life, and now it's time to move on to another character.
Right. The other thing that struck me reading it through this time is, of course, the major plot point of this story is the no girls allowed stipulation on the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes a moment of conflict between the boys and girls in this book. But I started to pick up on how a lot of the other stories in this book deal with issues of gender and what's the appropriate or inappropriate thing to be doing if you're a boy or a girl.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it starts with Henry again screwing up and forgetting he has a paper route and finding himself miles away from his route. And it turns out that his mom has to deliver the papers.
Yeah.
And that's played in some ways for laughs, but it's also to kind of show that his mom is going to, you know, she's kind of game for anything.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, because it's not, I wouldn't call this a progressive book by any means, but it is a book that looks at issues of gender roles and sees them as kind of a at least ripe for humor.
Well, I feel that Beverly Cleary has always, in her books, you know, even though she was definitely writing in the era in which she was writing, and she was definitely a person of the era when she lived, I feel like that she's always had a little bit more of an eye towards, you know, like you are not the gender, you are not the roles you're assigned in life, like, and you and people exist and are deeper and more thoughtful than simply the positions and the roles they have, you know, beyond their, people exist beyond just being a mom or being a wife or being a child or being a student or a teacher. And she's constantly pointing that out, that, like, you know, like, everyone has internal lives and everyone has wishes and dreams. And I feel like the first chapter where Henry rides in a bathtub way well beyond his ability to get back in time for the paper route, and then his mom has to deliver papers. And then, to me, it's the ending of that chapter where he's making fun of his mom to his dad. And his dad's like, your mom, you know, went out of her way to do this. Like, this isn't a funny thing. And now we're going out for a nice dinner to say thank you to your mom for doing this, because, you know, you should be the one who's responsible for this, not your mom. And she did a really nice thing for you. And it's, you know, not cool to make fun of her. I feel like that whole chapter is the entire novel in, like, microcosm. It's Henry being Henry, but also being a little more on the ball than usual, just because he's like, ah, no, wait, I've got responsibilities. Having to deal with the gender disparity issue, and also having to, you know, like, learn an internal lesson, like, sort of see people in a different light. And I feel like throughout the entire book, he's kind of doing this. He's seeing Ramona in a different light. He's seeing Beezus in a different light. He's even seeing the new neighbor in a different light. Like, everyone's, he's sort of learning to mature. He's maturing a little bit and learning to expand his view of people and grow up. Like, that's something that happens as you get older. You start sympathizing with people, empathizing with people, as opposed to just taking them at face value.
Yeah. Do you want to, should we do a recap here? I'm trying to, we're kind of getting into plot points here. I don't know if we're going to do a recap here or not.
Well, it's funny. So I was writing a summary. Yep. of the book, and like I do. And I got to the point where I was like, there's a lot going on in this book. Yeah. Like, it's not even like the teen books, which are very complex psychologically, tend to be very straightforward, point A to point B, but this involves basically three major through lines, which is, like, the story of Henry trying to be more responsible, like, trying to sell subscriptions, the story of Henry, like, trying to collect money, the story of Henry and his neighbor, the story of Henry and Ramona. Like, there's all these different plots, and I think it's a testament to Beverly Cleary's, like writing, that there are so many things happening, and then they all kind of tie together in the end. But it also made, like, writing a summary very difficult without it just being like 5 minutes of me just talking about what's happening in this book. So right. I was thinking that it might actually benefit from us just sort of doing a walkthrough like we used to.
Yeah,
do.
Yeah, sure. No, that's fine. Let's do a walkthrough, because it does start with Henry's resolution to get more customers.
Yeah.
And you know, to back this up with my experience as a paperboy. This is the worst aspect of being a paperboy, especially if you're a budding young introvert like me. The idea of going around and openly soliciting people to buy your newspaper. I realize now as an adult that they're very crafty, these newspaper magnates. They give this to the kids to do, you know. You get to go out and you get to be charming and sweet and cute and knock on the door, and who can say no to the kid who lives next door? But it was miserable going around trying to do that. And boy, it was like Amway. They really upsold you on, you got to get more customers. You know, this is, you know, the sky's the limit, but you got to get out there and get the customers.
Yeah, I never realized until I read this book, which I don't remember when I first did, but I never realized that was actually a part of being a paperboy, was being a salesperson.
Yeah, you know, actually, when I was a paperboy, they had a whole scam going. You were an independent distributor as the paperboy. You had to buy the papers yourself and sell them to the customers.
Oh, I've heard of that.
And
yeah,
generally that worked fine, but that was the way that the newspapers kept from getting stuck if a kid never told the paper that someone had canceled their subscription. Then you get to eat the cost.
Yeah.
So it keeps the kids on top of all that. I mean, I have no idea how papers, if they exist anymore. Do people read newspapers?
People do. They deliver the paper around here. I know it's a thing. They physically exist. I don't know who delivers them. I never see it happen, but...
Right.
But he's got this double bind, because his father is like, you know, you've got to prove yourself to be responsible enough to keep this paper route. But then he's also like being pressured to sell more papers, and then later on there's the even like more difficult chapter where he's trying to collect money from like a difficult customer.
Right.
There's the three aspects of this paper route that like cause me stress just reading about it.
Yeah. Henry goes for a ride in a bathtub. This is kind of the last hurrah for Mr. Grumby.
Mm-hmm.
A much
nicer Mr. Grumby than we've
seen.
He seems
to have mellowed. Mm-hmm. He's happy to put up with Henry's shenanigans, and in fact, he's encouraging Henry's shenanigans in this book.
Yeah,
and Henry, you know, I guess as scenes go, the idea of riding down to a dump in a open air in a bathtub, aside from being extremely dangerous, of course,
it's horrifying to think of.
It's sort of memorable. It's not like the most iconic image from the Henry books, but it's okay.
But it's a nice revisiting. This chapter is a nice revisiting. It's similar to Henry going up in the car when he was in Henry in the whatever book it was.
Right.
Where he rides up to the top of the car and gets trapped up there and bored. Yeah. And also it's a nice callback to the opening of the first Henry Huggins book, because it involves Henry just having to catch a bus.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was just a nice, like, yeah, this is how we started. We started with Henry having like his little like trouble getting on a bus, and but we're seeing a much more mature Henry now,
right?
And that's it. Like he gets home too late to start his paper route, and his mom is delivering papers, and he gets chewed out by his dad.
However, a great illustration by Lewis Darling of mom throwing the newspaper. And I remember you sent me the modern equivalent of this.
Yeah.
Not a great illustration.
It's not a great illustration in the new versions of the author of the newspaper. They're really pulling for the comedy in that one.
Right. While we were looking up the illustrations in this book, I came across an article about a recent exhibition of Lewis Darling's that was at the Eric Carle Museum, which is in Massachusetts. It's a museum dedicated to children's book illustration. And they said at the end of that there were going to be new editions of all the Henry Huggins books with the Lewis Darling illustrations reinstated. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think that's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Because it acknowledges that, like, it acknowledges that they are as much a part of the books as the words are. And it talked a little bit about his relationship with Beverly Cleary.
And it acknowledges that these books took place in the 1950s and 1960s. And
right.
Doesn't try to pull any shenanigans on us and say, like, oh, it actually happened in the mid-90s.
Right. Funny story. I had the privilege of visiting Mike Berenstain recently for my other podcast. And he talked a lot about children's publishing and dropped a lot of names. And so I just asked him his thoughts on Lewis Darling because I was like, I do a Beverly Cleary show. And so like, what do you think of, you know, like, what are your thoughts on Lewis Darling as an illustrator? And he'd never heard of him.
Really?
He'd never heard of him. He looked him up online and was like, oh, I recognize those. But I think it's just a part of, like, it was just like ships in the night. Like, that was a whole other world of children's illustration and children's publishing that he wasn't a part of it. So it just went off. It was not on his radar. Totally surprised me. I was like, I'm going to bring John back a wonderful anecdote about Lewis Darling that he's never heard of. And then it didn't happen. So I apologize.
Well, so in the next chapter, this is where we get really underway with the clubhouse and the instigating moment is that someone is tearing down a garage. And there's a bit of there's a funny bit here that I completely forgot, or probably, to be honest, as a kid, I just didn't read these paragraphs because they didn't interest me. They weren't about the kids. But there's a discussion about how the neighbor, Mr. Bingham, bought a new oversized car. Like, the cars were getting bigger and bigger at the end of the 50s and the early 60s, and he couldn't actually drive. Once he drove it into his garage, the doors wouldn't open. And so he had to back himself up out and announce to everyone that he's going to tear down his garage and build a new one. And it's a interesting little look into suburban whatever, you know, lifestyle, consumer culture of buying cars in the 60s.
Well, it's definitely, and definitely is something that you see evidence of in my neighborhood, because, in fact, the house right next to us, its garage, it doesn't exist anymore, but you can see on the back of the garage, which faces our house, that once upon a time, they had cut out and built two box extensions for the ends of cars. Which was something, and I was like, what's that? And then a neighbor was like, oh, yeah, they used to have to do that when cars became these incredibly long cars in the 1950s and 60s. All the garages had to be extended out to make room for these super long cars. And then after cars stopped being that way, they took those boxes off and replaced the wood. But the house, the garage, still has the scars of the original, I don't even know what you call them, hood boxes, whatever they were, but they're there. And so, like, and it is, to me, it's just when I read about it in this book, about just like, oh, cars don't fit in our garages anymore. I was like, yeah, it's a thing. Like, that's just one of those weird little things you had to contend with as a consumer.
You know, the other thing it occurs to me as I'm looking through the, just leafing through the book now, thinking about what the scenes all are in here. Ribsy doesn't have a lot to do in this book.
No, he's saving himself up for the next book.
Yeah, he's saving himself. But he gets into a dog fight. That's it.
He gets into a pretty bad dog fight.
Well,
He gets into a dog fight and he wears a hilarious Halloween mask. He has two good beats in this story. And they both have to do with the plot. Like, they're both plot affecting. But I think it's funny that Ramona has kind of become the Ribsy of the Henry books by this point.
Yeah, definitely.
She's the small animal who's causing problems for Henry.
Yeah.
Because, like, Ribsy's just kind of mellowed out.
Yeah, about everything interesting that happens in this book happens because of Ramona.
Yeah. So we find out in this chapter that she is obsessed with a TV show, a Howdy Doody-esque TV show. I assume there's a puppet involved somewhere. They never mention it. Called Sheriff Bud.
Right.
And that she's so obsessed with this television show, she goes around pretending to be Sheriff Bud, and has having hilarious exchanges in which she creates these, like, imaginary children at home and reads their imaginary letters. Like, it's, we're seeing Ramona develop as a character now in a way that goes along with her age. Like, suddenly she has this weird little personality.
Yeah.
Whereas before she was just a pesty kid.
Can we talk just a second about Sheriff Bud here? Because
yeah, I would love to.
He reminds me so much of when I was young, there was still out of Peoria a kids show that was the last hurrah of those local kids variety shows. It was called the Captain Jinx Show, and you can actually look it up on YouTube, Captain Jinx. It's spelled Cap'n Jinx. He was a guy who like dressed up in a sea captain, and he had this bosun named Salty Sam, and they would do commercials, and they would talk to kids in the audience. And it's so funny to me that still existed on into, I guess, the early 80s. These things existed everywhere in America back in the days when, you know, the network wasn't so constant. You know, if you joined a network, but that was for like 3 hours of programming a night, and the rest of the time you were on your own as a local affiliate. And there were all these local hosts out there, and you know,
was your local host again?
His name was Captain Jinx.
Captain Jinx. See, we had in Texas, we had Mr. Peppermint, who was the host. There was a Dallas show called Peppermint Place. Right. And it ran from, I think, the mid-70s to the mid-90s.
Right.
And Mr. Peppermint, who died. I know he's died. His son, though, Mr. Peppermint's son, is Gibby Haynes, the lead singer of the Butthole Surfers.
Just really?
For everyone out there. It was one of those little things that we were always proud of as Texans, like the the strange lineage of Mr. Peppermint to Gibby Haynes.
Right. And of course there were bozos everywhere.
Bozos were everywhere. And even to the degree of like the we all had our romper rooms. Everyone had their had their romper room version. So yeah, like it's just something that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I know, I don't think it does. Like, I don't know where you would see it, like except like on cable access.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I have not watched cable access in years, but I wouldn't be surprised if something existed there. But
I think like a lot of famous children's shows kind of grew out of that tradition.
Well, yeah, that's where Mr. Rogers came from. He was just like a local guy in Pittsburgh, and then he came along just when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was being founded, and he kind of rode that on. And of course, that's on its way out too now.
We
won't get into that.
Well, on that. But Sheriff Bud is definitely of this. I mean, all we know about Sheriff Bud really from the book is that he hosts this show. They show cartoons. He reads letters from kids, and he demands children go out and buy potato chips. Or demands children go out and demand their parents buy potato chips.
Yeah, this is an obsession of Clary's. She was very, I think, nearly every one of her books has some sort of a dig at commercials.
Yeah,
you know, either Ramona has a commercial jingle memorized, or she gives her dolls inappropriate names because they're named after consumer goods.
Yes,
or whatever, and. You know, there's the Wolfie's dog food commercial that features and whatever. You know, living today when everything... I mean, she's still alive. If she were writing now, what would she think about the world we live in today where everything is branded?
I think it's just one of those... I guess... I don't know if it's actually even so much like a critique on it. As because she was writing in the time,
right?
As just observation of this major cultural shift, that children were starting to recite commercials, and like these jingles and these songs were becoming a part of just everyday cultural life, like this like burgeoning pop culture that kids were suddenly aware of.
Well, that's fair because. Certainly, she writes about kids who watch television and who see movies and who still listen to the radio as all of these different forms of media are starting to become popular.
Yeah.
And I guess you're right. There's not really necessarily any critique so much as it's just the natural way in which all these things become part of a child's life.
It's very much Ramona. like, she's the character throughout the books who always seems to have this weird relationship with what's on television. Like, I know that that carries on through the Ramona books. She gets, like, jingles and catchphrases stuck in her head and gets in trouble for that, like, as it goes along. Beezus never really goes in that direction. And I'm wondering if that's, like, a fair, like, division between their generations. Like, Ramona is the first of these kids to, from birth, basically, grow up in front of a television. Yeah. Like, I'm wondering if Beezus didn't have that, but Ramona does because of their age difference.
Huh. You know, it occurs to me right now as you're saying this that Ramona is probably about the same age as Sally Draper.
Yeah.
Someone needs to write a story. Where,
how many parallels are you going to draw?
Someone needs to write a story where Ramona meets Sally Draper. And although the trouble is that Ramona doesn't age the same way. She's 5 for a good 10 years. And
I was going to say, how about like Ramona meets Sally Draper, but Ramona remains the perfect consumer because she manages to maintain the perfect consumable age throughout the decades. Like, Sally Draper keeps running into her across the decades, and Ramona is only like another year older, like every decade. So she's the perfect target market.
Right. In the mid-70s, Sally Draper is a young professional living in a Bleecker Street apartment, and she takes a job across the country, and she runs into Ramona again. Ramona is at that point 8.
Yeah. And then she's just like, just tell me what it's like to be this age for so long and how you relate to product and pop culture so that I can take this to Madison Avenue and become like the perfect advertiser.
Okay, this has actually been a backdoor pilot for our Mad Men podcast.
Yeah.
only three or 4 years too late.
Right. Oh, we're riding that zeitgeist. So we're only on chapter 2. And we haven't even gotten to the plot of the book yet. Henry gets his hands on all this discarded lumber, and he gets Robert and Murph. And if you remember, Murph is the like bookish nerd from a few books ago who now isn't as like socially awkward as he was in the previous books.
Right.
Like, he seems to have been incorporated into the neighborhood.
Well, he speaks with an enormous amount of authority. Both
yeah.
Henry and Robert just capitulate immediately to
anything. Yeah, they totally defer to everything he says.
Yeah.
Because Henry's like, let's build a clubhouse. And Murph's like, you can't just build a clubhouse. You have to have a plan. And they say that thing where, like, Henry's the kind of kid who just wants to do stuff. He doesn't want a plan. But Murph does. And Murph, like, comes up, I assume, with, like, really good blueprints.
Yeah, although, to be fair, it's just like a 4 foot by 5 foot square room, I guess.
They pour a foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's more than I would have known.
Well,
they make cement blocks. I guess they don't pour. They don't like dig out a basement and pour a foundation. they put up cement blocks, but
they
it
get
never
a backhoe and they.
It wouldn't have occurred to me to do that when I was a kid. Like, Murph just knows. He knows mechanical engineer. He understands how things work.
Right.
And he's going to build them a clubhouse that's going to last and survive the Portland elements.
Yeah.
But he also makes up this horrible rule.
Right. Yes. No girls allowed.
That's like his thing. And like, not just like, it's not offhand. Like, he is adamant about it. Right. Like, not even like helping them build the clubhouse.
Yeah. And it's sort of, in Murph's eyes, it should go without saying. He never gives any justification for it.
Right.
He just kind of states it like, oh, and as we all know, you know, no girls allowed.
And I'm wondering, like, because Beverly Cleary, or it's subtle in the way that it affects the friendship of Henry and Beezus, because they don't really, I mean, they call it out to an extent, but there's no, like, big confrontation. There's no, like, big, like, apology or anything for, like, Henry not letting Beezus take part in the clubhouse.
Yeah, you know, Beezus's reaction in here, and again, I'm going to draw a parallel that is probably far-fetched. It reminds me of Amy's discussion of being a cool girl in Gone Girl, because she doesn't want to make a big deal out of being treated poorly because she wants Henry to like her and to think, oh, I'm the cool girl. I'm the one who she puts a lot of stock in the fact that Henry thinks of her as sensible and likes her as a friend and doesn't treat her by her in any kind of gender essential way. Although we do know that Henry in the back of his head is constantly saying like, oh, she's pretty good for a girl.
Yeah. 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 Because we're never really allowed into Beezus's head through this book. We're stuck in from Henry's perspective the whole time. Yeah. We don't really get an idea of just how this is affecting Beezus, even in their final scene together. And it's a heck of a, like, I don't know. Even their final scene together, like at the clubhouse, it left me vaguely unsatisfied because the whole thing comes down to just a little bargain between the two of them that, I mean, I guess that's kind of maybe Beverly Cleary's way of saying, like, their story's not over. Like, there's no, like, they're not going to, like, suddenly declare their undying love for each other or, like, become the best of friends. Like, that's just not the way the kids work.
Right.
That's basically chapter two. Oh, Henry goes out to get subscriptions. And he meets a new neighbor who is kind of like the target. Like, she's the most obvious person to try to get a new subscription from. Right. And her name is Mrs. Peabody.
Yeah.
And she has a Dalmatian named Ranger who hates both Henry and Ribsy. And the dogs get into a huge fight.
Right.
Like, a huge dog fight. Like,
right. Like, one that actually threatens to harm or kill Ribsy.
Right. And no one seems that concerned with it, even Henry. Like, it's just considered, I guess, one of those things dogs do in neighborhoods.
Right.
Like, that would be considered really weird for me to see now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've touched on this a lot in these books, is how little concern people have for the welfare of the animals. Or just the safety hazard that animals on the loose pose to people.
Yes. Yeah.
Animals are just kind of left free to run around the neighborhood. If they get into fights, they get into fights. And the fear that Henry feels for Ranger, because Ranger doesn't like Henry and doesn't want Henry anywhere near this house, which thwarts Henry's ability to sell a subscription.
Mm-hmm.
That fear is very palpable to me. I remember several instances as a kid of walking by houses where people had dogs that were just out.
Yes.
And they were big and they were highly protective of their home.
Yeah. It's something that, and again, we've discussed this before, but it is that thing of like growing up in my neighborhood, like dogs were just allowed to roam free. And if you encountered a dog, like you learned from a young age, like how to approach a loose dog, like how to get it out of your way, how to avoid it, like how not to make it angry. And then, yeah, I guess we did see dogs get into fights and people did turn hoses on them, but it's so matter of fact in this book. It's so
can I also say as a PSA here, that was terrible. That led to a lot of anxiety for me as a kid. I got bitten quite frequently as a kid. It is not a better way to live. And just so all these memes on the internet about how when I was a kid, we didn't have anyone looking out for us. We never wore our bicycle helmets. This was terrible. This is life is better now.
Yes. Yes. I totally agree. I do want to point out in this book that before the dog fight, we have our first instance. I believe this is our first instance in a Beverly Cleary book of a peek inside the head of an animal. We have an exchange between Ribsy and Ranger, like a dialogue in growls. And they raise their lips, they bare their teeth as if they were sneering at each other. And just, who do you think you are? Ribsy's growl seemed to say. I have just as much right here as you have, Ranger's growl answered. No, you don't, said Ribsy. I was here first. I'm bigger, growled Ranger. You're a bully, growled Ribsy. Get off my property, Ranger told Ribsy. You make me, Ribsy told Ranger. Cut it out, both of you, ordered Henry. And I just love that, like, for a brief second, Beverly Cleary gives us a window into a completely different world on Klickitat Street, with completely different denizens, completely different rules, completely different social mores, and then pulls us right back out of it. Like, she lets us know that there is an entire other inner life going on, an entire other world and language going on beneath the waistlines of all the other characters, and unbeknownst to all the readers, in the next Ribsy-related book, we're going to be just thrust into that world feet first.
Yeah, no, that is a good point, and I will save some of my observations on that for when we get to
yes.
Ribsy. Except I'll say right now, this reminded me of, if you read The Lord of the Rings,
mm-hmm.
there's a sequence at the very beginning of The Fellowship of the Rings where the hobbits are leaving Hobbiton, and they go out and they camp the first night under a tree somewhere, and a fox comes along,
right.
and we're told what the fox thinks, and he says, "Hobbits outdoors? What a crazy world," or something, and he goes off,
yeah.
and it's like, what was that?
Yeah, I know exactly what part you're talking about. It's like, where's his story? It's like suddenly a character from The Wind in the Willows just like pops in, and there he is, and then he leaves. Yeah, and I no, it is a jarring. It's just as jarring. Like, it's that there's more to this story than you'll ever know. Like, yeah. This story is being observed from directions we won't have time to get into. Suffice to say, Henry doesn't get the subscription from the new neighbor. He's embarrassed. And then we go into Halloween, where Henry dresses as an Indian, and Ribsy gets dressed as, what is it, like a
wolf?
A wolf? Yeah, just like a werewolf or a monster wolf.
Right.
Because he thinks that, I don't know why he, why does he, oh, he wants to be an Indian with a wolf companion. He thinks it'll right. be the coolest costume.
Yes.
Fortunately, the whole, like, Indian costume thing is just sort of mentioned and, like, treated, and then it just moves on. Like, it's nothing, like, difficult to read, like, some of her earlier books.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a couple problematic things here. Beezus dresses up like a gypsy. This
yeah.
was the 60s, so.
It was the 60s, yeah, I mean, yeah. It didn't. They don't go into it. She's not, like, yeah. banging a tambourine or anything.
Right,
she's
right.
just, they just mention it. An Indian, a gypsy. I think when I read this book out loud the first time to my youngest, I think I changed it to like Beezus was dressed as a witch or something. I don't know. It was just something random.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to have to explain anything to her. So he goes trick or treating. They have their friends. Isn't Murph dressed as a robot?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That really lights up. One of the neighbors doesn't have treats and gives them a giant taxidermied barn owl,
yeah.
which is the most like random, bizarre, but fortunately plot fitting development that occurs.
You know, I swear there were moments in my childhood where I was walking down the street and people said, "Oh, you want," you know, they just call out the window, "You want this or whatever?" And people would just give me stuff, you know, and
yeah.
I would take it.
No, I was gonna say that doesn't happen here. People just put stuff in their alleys for anyone to take.
Yeah. When I was about 10, I was in California, I mentioned, during the Medfly invasion, and they mm-hmm. gave, I got 3 bags of avocados and 2 bags of peaches that day.
Wow.
So people just gave things away.
No owls, though.
No owls. That was, I always wanted a taxidermied owl. I guess it was, again, this book, you know.
This book. No, it's a giant owl. Its wings are spread. It's fierce. And they want to put it in their clubhouse. The guys are like, "This would be great in the clubhouse. It'd
yeah.
be just like a gentleman's club or something." And he's like a, and what happens though is he goes to Mrs. Peabody's house, and because he hears from, it's like one of the few instances Scooter appears in the story.
Oh right.
Like, I think Scooter is now at the age where he's just not interacting with these kids anymore. Like that's happened.
Yeah.
He's doing older kids stuff, and that makes sense. Like, it fits it. Like, he's not picking on the kids. He's just an older boy in the neighborhood now.
Yeah, he fades out. And, you know, when we get to the Ramona books, Henry is going to do much the similar thing.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just an older kid.
Yeah.
And Scooter tells him to go to Mrs. Peabody's, I think, because she has, like, super good treats. And the owl that they're carrying scares Ranger.
Right.
into submission, and that allows Henry to beg a subscription from Mrs. Peabody
because he wants to after they've gotten the subscription, he wants to go to Mr. Capper's house.
Oh, that's
to
right.
Tell him the news.
Oh, that's right. Because he puts the connection in his head about her pets. She's like, oh, I know a lot about dogs. I love pets. And she's like, pets. The newspaper has a cool pet section. And then he launches into his sales spiel about the pet section. And it's a nice moment. She's like, I've been waiting for you to sell me a subscription. I knew you were the paper boy.
Right.
And I was going to give you I like Mrs. Peabody a lot. She does, however, think that his name is Harry Higgins, which is, he's too embarrassed to correct. And I love that because to me, that's such a real thing that happens. Yeah. And he experiences the thing throughout the book where the longer he lets her call him Harry Higgins, the less likely it is that he will ever be able to correct her.
Yeah.
Because then it just becomes awkward for both of them.
You know, you mentioned when he talks about the pet section. Earlier on in the book, he's talking about his whole spiel about how he would approach someone and talk about what they have in the paper. And he's listing off all these sections. And he's saying, like, the sports section, the crossword puzzle. And he says, the church section.
Yeah.
And this made like a little shiver go down my back, because when I was growing up in Eureka, Illinois, there was a local paper called the Woodford County Journal, and there were society columns there. There was one for each of the small towns around Eureka. Eureka had only 4,000 people in it, but Goodfield, which was about 7 miles away, had 500 people in it, and it had a society column.
Amazing.
And it was written by Mrs. Robert McGinnis, who would write things like, Joe and Ethel Knapp entertained their uncle and aunt at their home last Thursday. And this was the news. You would read through this whole column. It would be like talking about who went to visit whom and whether or not so-and-so was putting in a garden that year.
Would you submit this stuff yourself?
I don't know where,
about someone else?
I don't know where Mrs. Robert McGinnis got her news. But both the Goodfield column and the Congerville column were written by Mrs. Robert McGinnis, and I've often wished I had met this woman. I'm sure she is has long since left us.
Was it a woman, or was it like an actual like a name for like a network of like spies? Or
God only knows. But like, but when I went, but you know how, when you're a teenager, you want nothing to do with your parents. You want nothing to do with the town you grew up with. And then when I went off to college, I asked for a subscription to the Woodford County Journal so I could get to these columns from time to time.
Mrs. Robert McGinnis.
Yes.
Oh, did you ever appear in the society column?
You know, I didn't. But what happened was when I just got out of college, I tried to become a cartoonist for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I think a couple of local newspapers ran stories on me because I had won some contest here in Boston. Nothing came of it, and thank God in retrospect, because I was trying to become a cartoonist right in the early 90s, and the web was about to be invented in 95 and destroy newspapers forever. So
you could have had the next Snuffy Smith or Lil Abner. I can't think of any other, like Gasoline Alley. I don't In any case,
if you want to have a classic comic strip podcast, we can do that one next. I certainly have a lot of opinions on.
I don't know if I could afford the Fantagraphic. I don't have the budget for that many Fantagraphic volumes.
You can get all the Popeyes for cheap through Hamilton Books.
Oh, that's true. That's true. They do mark them down pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Like, come to find out, like the market for Little Orphan Annie reprints wasn't quite as big as they thought.
What do you mean we won't be able to finish our Polly and the Her Pals series?
We got Cats and Jammer Kids, both versions, just sitting in the warehouse. Any case, so the next chapter is just Henry trying to get payment from a difficult customer.
Right.
And nothing much happens in it except that it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And this neighbor, I feel very bad for her, and I feel very bad for Henry and everyone involved. It's like you get a glimpse into a lower income family than Henry and his family. And like I don't know if it means anything, but like their clothes washer is in the kitchen.
Yeah.
She has a bunch of kids. She's very harried. She just doesn't seem to be able to keep track of anything. She never has enough money. She doesn't have the money to pay Henry. How much is it? Like $2?
Right. Now, don't put too much emphasis on the clothes washer being in the kitchen, because I believe at this time a lot of people had portable washers that you would hook up with a hose to your kitchen sink, and you then would roll away because you didn't have the plumbing in place in the house for a clothes washer.
Even with the spin cycle?
Yeah, they had spin cycles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because Ramona opens it during the spin cycle, and water goes everywhere. Yeah. And, like, you get, like, I don't, there's something, a kid eats a sandwich off the ground. I don't remember what it was. Like, just, it's, you suddenly step into a whole other book series.
Right. And there's a kid named Kermit.
There's a kid named Kermit.
And I've never actually met anyone in my life named Kermit other than Kermit the Frog.
I knew a Kermit. There was a Kermit. A professor named Kermit when I went to college, I believe. But yeah, it's not a common name anymore because of the Frog Association.
Right.
These kids are like one step away from becoming like Boxcar Children. Like they are, this family is kind of on the verge. And I don't remember if anything really plot specific happens in
not
it.
Not much
than...
plot specific happens, but it does reinforce, I think, the idea of gender roles, because briefly Henry is told to take care of however many kids are here, like
right.
4 to 6 kids, whoever knows, and he fails utterly. Not that the mom has been doing much better, but right. he's just thrust into this role of taking care of a bunch of kids, and
yeah.
that's supposed to be hilarious, I guess.
You also see Ramona like being Ramona, like that gives yeah. you another opportunity to see like Ramona bothering Henry, which becomes a big theme. Ramona just happens to be there. She's just playing at the house. And Henry develops a new way to track payments. Like you see this little development of him as a businessman. He decides to like write down the paying schedule for all of his customers and keep track of it that way.
Yeah.
But that's it. Like that's all that happens in the chapter. It's just awkward for everyone. And I felt bad for everybody involved. I want to get on to the next chapter because the next chapter involves fadada, 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 beepum, bapum, boopum, the worst thing in the world. I hate it so much.
Now, would it surprise you to know that I actually memorized this when I read the book?
How does it go?
Fadada, 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 beepum, boopum, ba, ratatatatata, afadidi, boomsh. That's how I remember it from my childhood. I'm not looking at it right now.
I listened to this book on audio also, and Neil Patrick Harris was the reader, and even he couldn't seem to figure out what the rhythm was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like I keep reading over and over it. I can't figure out if I'm missing how it's supposed. Fadada, fadada, fadada.
Beepum,
beepum, boopum, ba. Rada, dada, boom, sh. Afa dee dee bobo.
Bobo? Boo boo? I don't know. But you know what this sounds like to me is it sounds like another actual incident from
yes.
Clary's
life. It is too specific.
Yeah.
But also, like a thing from Beverly Cleary's actual life, it seems to me it's something that actually would have like more likely happened like closer to the Depression.
Right. So for everyone out there who's super confused about this, this was something that Murph taught the other two kids. You know, this is Clubhouse is basically Murph, Robert, and Henry.
Yeah.
And they have this idea that they are going to use this password to get into the clubhouse. Of course,
yeah.
Because that's the way kids think, you know. It's not like, oh, hi, it's you, Murph, I'll let you in.
What's really weird, though, is this: it's the way it's introduced. It says, while the boys worked, Murph began to recite some strange sounds. They were not words, so Henry and Robert had trouble catching exactly what he was saying. The syllables, whatever they were, had a catchy sound and rhythm. Say that again, Murph. Henry found himself wanting to make the sounds himself. And I'm like, this is like something out of a Lovecraft story. Like, this is like, you hear this like strange language and you're like compelled to do it. He says he learned it from his cousin in California. He learned it from a lifeguard.
Right.
Like, there's this, and it's very true to life. It's very true to kids. Like, there is this sudden mythology built up around this stupid thing. And it becomes the most important thing to them. And I guess that's how kids work.
Right.
Like, it's this dumb rhyme that they learn. Murph laid down his hammer and recited slowly and distinctly, fadada, 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 beepum, boopum, ba, rada, dada, boom, shh, afa, didi, bobo. And then the Henry and Robert laid down their tools too. Fadada, fadada, fadada. And like, it just, you go through this like thing where they're learning these ridiculous words, which then becomes the club password. Right. Which is stupid because they're the only three members of the club.
Right. Right. No, it's and they have a long discussion about how they're going to distribute the keys since there are only two keys. This comes up later when they have to padlock the door because someone has been sneaking into the clubhouse.
Someone starts sneaking into the clubhouse and dressing up their taxidermied owl and moving its eyes so it's cross-eyed, putting up a sign that says "Down with Boys." And generally not doing much to be a nuisance, but doing enough to tick off someone like Murph.
You know, if I had a friend who was sneaking into my clubhouse and changing things when I wasn't there, I would keep that going as long as I could. That seems like a good time to me.
Yeah, these boys have no sense of humor about their clubhouse. Like, it's a serious business. Which I guess, you know, is Beverly Cleary kind of poking fun at their, like, lame lives.
Right.
Because, again, it is only the three of them. Like, they're not inviting any of their other friends to take part in this. It's just them. And they eventually do get the padlock for the door. They paint the house. And there's this part where the Beezus and Ramona keep walking by to see what's going on, but the boys are like ignoring her, and there's this exchange. "I guess we fixed her," the boys congratulated one another. "You won't catch her bothering us anymore." And when the girls were gone, they chanted their magic words, fadada, 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 beep. And I'm like, this is just, like, it's a very strange ritualistic boys club. Like, I guess it's like the birth of like the men's clubs. Like, not only is it a callback, it has to be a callback to something from Beverly Cleary's childhood. Right. It is definitely Beverly Cleary making fun of the ridiculousness of the way these boys are behaving.
Are you implying that if this took place today, Murph would use as the password Peppy the Frog?
Yes. Oh, yes. I don't like Murph. You told me before we recorded a few days ago to let go of Murph. So I said, like, I wasn't just going to go off on Murph. I do not like Murph. Like, I just want to put that out there. He doesn't get any kind of comeuppance. He doesn't learn any lesson. He disappears before the end of the book. He says goodbye to the book. And we never even find out, like, really what happens to the clubhouse. Like, after this chapter, it's a non-entity.
Well, at the end of the book, we have this enormous snow.
Yeah.
Isn't there something about them wanting to go out and camp out in the snow? And
yeah, he wants to sleep in the clubhouse.
Right, but he won't.
And his mom's like, no.
I mean, what are the odds that by next spring it's been it's just like a pile of mush?
Yeah, forgotten about, abandoned in the backyard. Well, Henry gets locked in the clubhouse by Ramona,
right?
Which is brilliant, and it's a little insight into Ramona too, because Ramona locks him in the clubhouse basically because he's been treating Beezus bad. Which is a little, like, you don't hear anything about it, but it basically is, to me, it's the book's way of saying Beezus is upset about this because Ramona's picking up on it.
Yeah.
And it also shows that Ramona's growing up a little bit. She's developing empathy. She's developing a sense of injustice outside of herself. But she locks Henry in the clubhouse and she won't let him out what does he tell her? Well, he tells her where the key is?
No, he can't figure out how to get out. You know, he's banging off the walls.
Yeah.
He can't break his way out. So he starts chanting the fadada, fadada, fadada.
Right.
As it's like it's going to magic him out of the clubhouse. And she immediately falls into its thrall.
Yes. Say that again, Henry. Right. She begged.
Right. So he has to completely... he has to utterly break all of his pinky swears to his fellow bros, because on top of on top of promising that they would never let girls into the clubhouse, they've all promised that they would never teach anyone else the magic words.
And so he says, yes, he says to Ramon, I'll teach you the magic words if you go get Beezus. And I didn't remember this. He says, and tell her I'm sorry.
Right.
So there is an apology, an implicit apology. They don't ever go into it, but it's there. Like, he does apologize for his jerky behavior to her. So I was wrong.
This also builds on what you said earlier about this being a book about Henry wanting to take on more responsibility, because what the instigating thing is not just that he's locked in the house. He could stay in the house till his parents came home. He has to get out and deliver these papers, and he's already screwed up once, and he has to get out. And the minute he realizes that, it's fine. He's going to drop all this stupid childhood stuff and go ahead and do whatever it takes to get out of the house.
Yeah. And he does. Yeah. He teaches Beezus the fadada, fadada, fadadas. Beezus teaches it to Ramona. Henry gets out and starts his paper route. Before you know it, everyone in school is saying fadada, fadada, fadada. Like, there's a whole other book right there as well. Like, what happens at Glenwood School?
Right. The next chapter is all of Glenwood School saying the fadada, fadada, fadadas. And it reminded me briefly of the gumball incidents. It's sort of like this school just goes through crazes.
Yes. Again, not modern times. These kids are looking for fun, and they'll take it wherever they can get it. But Henry's getting tired of being pestered by Ramona. His father suggests that Henry's smart enough to outsmart a five-year-old, which is probably true. And I think this is my favorite chapter in the book, because Henry puts two and two together that Ramona's obsessed with Sheriff Bud, that she will listen to Sheriff Bud, and that Sheriff Bud reads letters on his show. So Henry writes a letter to Sheriff Bud basically saying, I'm being bugged by this kid on my paper route. Could you please tell her to cut it out? And it works.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Right.
And I love the building of tension as Henry goes over to Beezus's house to play checkers just to watch Sheriff Bud to see if his letter is going to get read and how it doesn't. And then he comes back and the show is, and then like Ramona's mother threatens to turn the TV off and Henry's like, ah, and then it does happen. Like Sheriff Bud's like, I got a letter here from Henry Huggins. And it's just this, everyone just goes quiet. He's like, this is for Ramona Quimby. And you're just like, what? And it's this incredibly magical moment where Ramona is being talked to by her favorite television character, who tells her to lay off Henry Huggins on his paper route.
Right.
And Henry feels at this point that he has leverage over Ramona. Unfortunately, of course, it backfires on him.
Right. Well, it backfires insofar as now Henry gets some of Sheriff Bud's magic by proxy.
Yes.
And so maybe Ramona doesn't want to pester Henry so much. She doesn't want to intentionally antagonize Henry, but what she does is she wants to be like Henry.
Yes.
She wants to be with Henry every moment of every day. And in the last chapter, she starts following Henry about the place and shows up with her own journal bag.
Yeah,
which she got for Christmas that her mother made for her. And again, this touched something in me, because my mom made so many things when I was a kid. I don't know how. I mean, there are certainly people who still sew, but it really seemed when I was a kid like every mother was expected to sew.
Yes.
In fact, there was a lot of anxiety if you were a woman in the 70s who didn't know how to sew, because you're like wanting to maybe cast aside gender roles, but on the other hand, there was such a high expectation that this was something you were going to do.
Yeah, and on the other hand, there were all these great McCall's patterns.
Yes, exactly.
I was really jealous when three of my friends in the neighborhood, who I thought I was part of their group, their moms made them each a Three Amigos costume. And
wait, McCall's had a Three Amigos costume?
No, their moms created their own pattern. made them each Three Amigos costumes because they wanted to just dress up like the Three Amigos. And I was the fourth member of this friendship, and I wasn't asked to be a part of it.
Huh.
That's a whole other story, but it was that thing of, like, they really wanted this thing to be made, and so the mothers were expected to make them these costumes. And those were elaborate costumes.
Yeah, they're like mariachi band
kind yeah, of things. They had, like, these jackets and, like, the white, like, piping and
now,
the hats.
Now,
and
I hate to ask it, but were your friends all white?
Of course.
Right.
But then so were the Three Amigos.
So, right, that's what I'm saying. So they would leave out the one guy who could possibly call himself Amigo.
Oh, right. That's true. I hadn't thought of it that way. Maybe they were like, too on the nose. I don't. Maybe they were like, we can ask Phil to be like El Guapo, but they just never got around to asking. Or like whoever John Lovett's character was named. But no, like, it's true. Like, she asks her mom for a newspaper bag for Christmas, and her mom is like, well, of course she had to, like, just make her one. Like, that's all she wanted. She wanted to be like Henry Huggins. And Henry's embarrassed to have this little kid toddling along after him, but he can't do anything about it because she's literally not bugging, like, not pestering him. She's not actually doing anything. She's trying to be helpful.
Right.
And, yeah, so what ends up happening is there's a huge snow in the neighborhood, and Henry can't ride his bike anymore, which means that Ramona can actually follow him, which is something she couldn't do when he was riding his bike. And people are like, oh, you got a little shadow with you. And this is kind of where everything, like, converges, like all the different plot points come together.
Yeah, definitely. Because, after the particularly bad snow where they have over a foot of snow, Ramona becomes too tired to walk, and Henry, feeling responsible for her, agrees to pull her along on a sled. He gets... I love the fact that the minute he starts doing that, she starts calling out mush.
Yes.
but of course what happens is his heroism is noticed by Mrs. Peabody.
Yes.
And Mrs. Peabody's mispronunciation of his name is noticed by Ramona.
Yep.
Who corrects her loudly and without any of the shyness that Henry feels.
And because his heroism is noticed by Mrs. Peabody, she writes a letter to the newspaper about this wonderful paperboy, Henry Huggins, who selflessly pulled a child in a sled. And that letter proves to his father that he's responsible enough to continue doing the paper route. And it just kind of ties everything up very nicely and rather organically, like, right. And unexpectedly in this nice little, like, package.
Right. And Henry gets a sleeping bag, which was kind of the MacGuffin for this book, you know. In other books, Henry wanted a bike. He wanted, in this book, he wanted a clubhouse, but he got that halfway through. So
yes,
they gave him another thing.
It's called Henry and the Clubhouse because the clubhouse kind of symbolizing how Henry is taking on a lot more responsibility than his father feels he's capable of juggling. And so the clubhouse is kind of this symbol of, like, of man's hubris. I don't know, like, of, like, Henry's, just like his tendency to, like, overdo things or take on more than he can chew. And at the end of the book, his father's impressed. He's like, wow, you really did it. You worked hard and you stuck to it. You got the subscriptions and you made an impression on your customers and you built the clubhouse and you didn't miss your paper route and you handled it, like, and you did it, like, good job. And he gives Henry the rest of the money that Henry needs for his sleeping bag. And I don't know. It's just like it's a nice ending. The book ends with them, like, all running out to, like, get extra copies of the paper to send, like, to relatives.
Right. And if I were to get overly sentimental and try to really stretch the metaphor, the clubhouse also kind of represents this stopping point between the kind of, you know, the child Henry and the coming teenage Henry. It's a moment that on the one hand typifies childhood. On the other hand, building it is not easy, and funding it and actually planning and following through are all hallmarks of Henry getting older.
Yes.
Now, this is not, again, Beverly Cleary is not the kind of writer who is going to give you these huge moments that, you know, that she's going to underscore and tell us what exactly this means to the characters. But they're these quiet, lovely little moments. And because it's the last time we get to see Henry, you know, I'm loading it with more meaning than it has. But it you know, when we finished this book, I really felt very sad. You know, I realized this was it for Henry. I mean, obviously he shows up again in the Ramona
books. And he's a bit of a bit player in the Ribsy book. He's in the book as a main character. He's just not the main character. The book isn't told from his POV.
But both those books are very different books. I mean, this is the last of this kind of book.
Yeah.
I think this is actually the last of this kind of book all over. I mean, we're going to next get into, there's going to be another teen book. Mm-hmm. There's the Ribsy book. And then the Mouse books.
She's shifting gears now.
It's fascinating to me that there wasn't a real capper to this book. You know, when we get to the end of the Ramona books, you know, she actually felt when she left off, not Ramona. With Ramona Forever, I think she had a feeling she was done. And it feels that way when she... Now, of course, she later wrote Ramona's World in the mid-90s, but that was kind of like an afterthought, like, okay, I'm still alive. People want another Ramona book. Here I go, you know.
Yeah.
But there was a feeling when you get to Ramona Forever that she really wanted to, like, take this moment and end this.
Yeah.
This doesn't feel like she had any sense that she was going to do that with Henry. It was like she could very easily have gone on to write more. But
I don't know, because the book ends... I mean, this is just me.
Yeah.
But I definitely think the book ends by shifting... The book ends by shifting attention to Ramona.
Yeah.
And I think it's telling the last three words of the book are good old Ramona.
Yeah,
and that the first word of the first book is Henry... And the last word of the last Henry book is Ramona.
Yeah.
And I think that she's like, this is where... to me, it feels like she knows this is where it's going. That Henry's going to become... Henry's like... The story she wanted to tell with Henry has now like run its course. And Ribsy's going to be like a bridging book between like the two. And then she'll write a few more books. And then she'll show up again in a few years with Ramona the Pest. I don't know. Like I feel like Henry in the Clubhouse is a little more of a capper, I think, than you seem to feel.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just dubious because I feel like I want there to be some sort of a moment here, but again, that's not the way that Cleary writes her books. She's not going to give us that. Like, and Henry would never forget that summer with the Clubhouse.
No, yeah, you don't get the, like, as Henry looked back, you know, he thought about the time he wanted that bike, and he thought about the time that he just thought fishing with his dad would be a good, like, look how far I've come.
Right.
Because I think Beverly Cleary's smart enough to know that kids aren't self-reflective.
Sure.
Like, you operate that way as an adult, but kids don't operate that way. Like, they just keep going. And... like you had said earlier, when Henry shows back up in Ramona the Pest, he's a very different character.
Yeah.
And because I read the Ramona books first, that's how I was introduced to Henry, was as this sort of like taciturn older boy, like humorless and just fed up with our heroine.
Right. In a later book still, I don't remember whether it's Ramona the Brave or Ramona and her father, the last time we actually hear about Henry, it's Beza saying, like, oh, Henry's just out running. That's all he does these days is run track.
Yeah.
And it's such a kind of a sad way to leave him.
But I guess that's, I mean, you know, like, leave it to Beverly Cleary to, like, represent kids the way kids are.
Right.
Which is fickle and not romantic and not constantly worrying about making sure every moment is captured and everything is noticed, because they're going to live forever and their lives are just going to keep going on. And they're not grownups who are, like, mired in nostalgia.
Well, we are mired in nostalgia.
We are. Did you know that we have a Beverly Cleary podcast?
Well, that sounds like something I'd like to listen to.
Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast, is on the Incomparable Network. For more information, visit theincomparable.com.